Imagine a broker, right? And he's recommending this perfectly safe, highly rated mutual fund to his client.
Okay.
So the client buys it, the market goes up, the client makes money, and the risk perfectly matches their financial profile. I mean, everyone is happy.
Sounds like a win.
Right. But that broker still loses his license and goes straight to regulatory jail.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it's all because his firm promised him like a free toaster if he sold that specific fund by Friday.
Oh, man. Yep.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're exploring the strict, sometimes completely counterintuitive world of financial regulation.
Where, good intentions mean absolutely nothing if you don't follow the exact mechanics of the law.
Exactly. But really quickly, before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they've got a full Series 6 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing.
Which is huge.
Yeah, it's built to actually help you remember this stuff, not just, stare at a page until your eyes glaze over. So check it out at certfuel.com.
For sure.
Okay, so if you're prepping for the Series 6, the topics we're covering today, customer investment profiles and suitability, these are the absolute bedrock of what a registered rep does.
Bedrock, yeah.
It's a massive chunk of your test. But instead of just reading you a list of rules like some dry compliance manual, we're going to figure out why these rules were written in the first place.
Right, because I mean, every single rule in the Finaro Handbook or the SEC guidelines, it was essentially written in blood.
Wow, written in blood.
Or, well, at least written in the aftermath of massive financial ruin.
Oh,
You know,
man.
regulators don't just wake up and invent paperwork for fun.
No, it feels like it sometime.
It does, it really does. But they look at a disaster like the 2008 financial crisis or the dot-com bubble or just a massive churning scandal, and they build a regulatory wall to stop it from happening again.
Right.
If you understand the disaster, you understand the rule. And
Yeah.
if you understand the rule, you can navigate, any tricky, convoluted scenario the exam throws at you.
So to help us visualize these disasters, we're bringing in a recurring cast of characters today.
Love
I
this.
want you to really picture them in your head. First, we have Frantic Frank.
Frantic Frank, okay.
Frank is a well-meaning but constantly confused Series 6 registered rep. He's always sweating, always trying to hit his quotas, and just always one bad decision away from a compliance violation.
We all know Frank.
Yeah, we do. Next, we have his client, Cautious Carl. Carl is a retail customer. He's incredibly risk-averse. He's in a very low tax bracket, and he treats his life savings like it's made of fragile glass.
Makes sense.
Finally, we have 50 Million Fiona.
Oh, there we go.
She is an ultra-wealthy tech founder who insists on doing things her way, moves at a million miles an hour, and has the bank account to basically ignore standard advice.
So keeping Frank, Carl, and Fiona in mind will really help ground these abstract legal concepts. And for everyone listening, especially if, standard lectures usually put you to sleep, which they do for a lot of people with ADHD, we're going to actively pull you into this conversation.
Definitely.
Periodically, we'll pose a scenario and ask you a direct question. And before we give you the answer, I want you to actually pause.
Yeah, shout the answer out loud if you're alone, or just, lock it into your brain.
The friction of trying to guess the answer is what builds that muscle memory you need for the exam.
All right, so let's start at the very foundation, which is the difference between KYC and suitability.
Crucial difference.
You hear people in the industry throw these acronyms around interchangeably, but for the Series 6, treating them like the same thing is a fatal error,
Oh,
right?
absolutely. They are triggered by completely different things.
Okay, lay it out for us.
They belong to entirely different eras of regulation, really. So KYC stands for Know Your Customer.
Right.
You can think of KYC as the absolute always-on baseline. It's driven heavily by anti-money laundering laws, like the USA Patriot Act that passed after 9/11. Gotcha. The government needs to know that the person opening a brokerage account is an actual human being, not some front for a cartel or a terrorist organization.
Okay, so it's like, who is this person? Do we have their government-issued ID? Who has the legal authority to trade in this account?
Exactly.
So KYC is essentially a bouncer at a nightclub checking your ID.
I love that analogy.
The bouncer doesn't care if you have a 401k or what your risk tolerance is or if you're making a huge mistake going into this club. They just need to verify that you are who you say you are, you're old enough to be there, and you aren't on some kind of watch list.
Yes. Basic entry and account servicing. That is the exact mechanism.
Right.
KYC applies to every single account, period. Even if you never ever give that customer a single piece of financial advice, you still have to verify their identity.
Okay, but suitability is different.
Completely. Suitability is a much deeper regulatory layer, and it is only triggered when a registered rep makes a recommendation.
Oh, okay. So if Frantic Frank never makes a recommendation to Cautious Carl, Frank has zero suitability obligations.
None at all.
But the second Frank opens his mouth to give advice, he crosses an invisible tripwire.
Boom, tripwire crossed.
So if KYC is the bouncer checking your ID at the door, suitability is like going to a doctor who refuses to prescribe you anything until you've filled out a massive, highly invasive medical history form.
That's spot on. Frank needs a deep level of intimacy with Carl's financial life to legally suggest a product.
So Fenner calls that medical history form the customer investment profile, right?
Right. To establish a factual predicate for any advice, the suitability rule demands that Frank make reasonable efforts to gather 9 specific factors, plus a catch-all.
Okay, and this isn't just arbitrary data collection. Let's look at the logic. The list includes things like age, other investments, financial situation and needs, tax status, investment objectives, investment experience, investment time horizon, liquidity needs, and risk tolerance.
It's a lot.
It is. We also have the catch-all, which is any other information the customer discloses. So why does Frank need to know Carl's tax status, for example?
Because the mechanics of certain financial products are deeply intertwined with the tax code.
Okay.
If Frank doesn't know that Carl is in the lowest possible tax bracket, he might recommend a tax-free municipal bond.
And why is that bad?
Well, municipal bonds typically pay a lower interest rate because the investor doesn't have to pay federal taxes on the gains.
Right, that's the trade-off.
But Carl doesn't pay much in taxes anyway. So if Frank sells him that bond, Carl is just accepting a lower yield for a tax shield he cannot use. It's mechanical malpractice.
Oh, wow. He's selling Carl an expensive umbrella, but Carl lives in the Sahara Desert.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense. So Frank needs the full picture. Now, I know there is a massive exam trap hiding in this specific list of factors.
Oh yeah, a huge one.
Because FINAMA has another document, the Short Form Function 2.3 Activity Statement, which only lists a few of these profile items, like other holdings and tax status.
Right, and the exam writers know candidates study that short form list.
Yeah.
So they will test you on the 2 critical factors that were explicitly added to the long form suitability rule.
Which are?
Risk tolerance and investment time horizon.
Okay, say that again.
Risk tolerance and investment time horizon. You cannot make a suitable recommendation without knowing how much volatility Carl can stomach and exactly when he plans to withdraw the money.
Makes sense.
If you don't have those 2 puzzle pieces, you are flying blind.
Okay, so listener, here is your first active recall scenario. I want you to really think this through.
Get ready.
Cautious Carl walks into Frantic Frank's office to open a new account. Frank starts going down the list. He asks for Carl's ID, which Carl provides.
So KYC is done.
Right. But when Frank asks for Carl's net worth, his tax status, and his risk tolerance, Carl crosses his arms. He's incredibly private, and he flat out refuses to give Frank those financial details.
Typical Carl.
Yeah. So if you are Frank, what do you do? Do you have to kick Carl out of the office because you can't complete the profile? Take a beaten answer.
Okay, you got it. The answer is no, you don't kick him out.
Really?
Yeah, Frank can absolutely still open the account. Going back to our bouncer analogy, Carl showed his ID. The KYC requirement is satisfied.
But what about the advice? Frank can't just guess his tax status, right?
Frank doesn't guess, and he shouldn't guess. The rule says Frank must document Carl's refusal in writing.
Okay.
From that moment on, Frank is legally paralyzed when it comes to giving advice. He cannot make any recommendations that would require that missing information.
Which is almost everything.
Exactly. Since almost all recommendations require knowing someone's financial situation, Frank essentially becomes an order taker. He can only execute unsolicited, customer-directed trades.
So Carl becomes the captain of his own ship.
He does.
If Carl wants to steer the ship into an iceberg by buying something crazy, Frank just has to say, aye, aye, Captain, and execute the trade.
That's right.
Because Frank can't suggest a safer route because he doesn't know how much fuel is in Carl's tank or what the hull is made of.
That's the perfect way to look at it. If the customer refuses to provide the profile, the rep's ability to act as an advisor just vanishes.
Okay, so we know Frank needs this deep dive profile if he makes a recommendation. But let's dig into the mechanics of that trigger.
Let's do it.
What actually constitutes a recommendation in the eyes of FINRA?
Yeah.
Because I assume it's more than just saying buy this.
It is vastly broader than most reps realize. And this is where careers get derailed.
Oh, boy.
A recommendation is defined as a call to action that could reasonably influence a customer to trade a security or adopt an investment strategy.
Okay.
Yes, saying buy the XYZ growth fund or sell those ABC bonds are obvious triggers. But regulators are well aware of the clever games brokers try to play to avoid liability.
Let me guess. Brokers try to give advice without actually telling them to buy or sell something new.
Exactly. Which brings us to the most dangerous hidden trigger on the exam. The hold trap.
The hold trap. Okay, listener, let's put Frank and Carl into another scenario.
All right, focus up.
2 years ago, before he ever met Frank, cautious Carl bought a highly volatile leveraged tech fund all by himself online. It was completely unsolicited.
Okay.
Fast forward to today, Carl transfers his account to frantic Frank. Carl is looking at his statement, the market is getting choppy, and he calls Frank in a panic. He asks, Frank, should I stay in this tech fund?
And what does Frank do?
Frank, just trying to be a calming presence, says, don't panic, Carl. Yes, keep holding it. Ride it out.
Oh, Frank.
So has Frank just made a recommendation?
By explicitly saying, yes, keep holding, Frank just sprung the regulatory trap. He made a recommendation.
But wait. Frank didn't sell him the fund. Carl bought it years ago on his own. All Frank did was tell him to do nothing. How is doing nothing a call to action?
Because in finance, deciding to hold an asset is an active daily decision not to sell it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. When Frank said keep holding, he validated that asset. And the mechanism here is fascinating. The suitability clock instantly resets to zero.
The clock resets.
Yep. Frank now owns that recommendation. He must evaluate that volatile tech fund against cautious Carl's current profile today, not his profile from 2 years ago.
So it's like Carl brought a stray, rabid dog into the office, and by saying keep holding, Frank just formally adopted the dog.
He adopted the dog, and he is now legally responsible if it bites someone.
That is wild.
But think about why this rule exists. Life changes.
Yeah.
You know? If Carl bought that fund 2 years ago when he was working, but today he just retired and needs stable income.
Right.
That tech fund might have been fine then, but it's completely unsuitable to hold now. Frank has to do the analysis today.
Okay. What if Frank is a bit more devious?
They often are.
What if Frank knows the rules and actively avoids naming a specific security? Let's say Frank says, hey, Carl, the market is weird right now. You should really start dollar cost averaging into large cap equities. Or he says, you should look into a sector rotation strategy.
Okay.
Frank doesn't name a single mutual fund ticker. He's just talking high-level strategy. Is he safe?
Nice try, Frank, but no. FINRA explicitly states that recommending an investment strategy involving securities triggers the suitability rule, even if no specific security is ever named.
Are you serious?
Yep. Dollar cost averaging, sector rotation, laddering bond maturities if you recommend the method, suitability applies.
Wow.
The logic is that a strategy can be just as dangerous as a specific product. Frank has to have a reasonable basis to believe that dollar cost averaging into equities actually fits Carl's risk-averse profile.
So the net is cast incredibly wide. Buy, sell, hold, and unnamed strategies all trigger the need for a full suitability profile.
They all do.
Is there anything a rep can say to a client that doesn't trigger this massive compliance checklist? Like, can they talk about the weather?
They can talk about the weather, and they can rely on three specific safe harbors carved out by FINRA.
Safe harbors, okay.
Yeah, these are categories of communication that explicitly do not count as recommendations.
What are they?
First, general financial education. Second, generic asset allocation models. And third, interactive investment tools that incorporate those educational models.
So, general financial education. Meaning Frank can explain the basic mathematical concepts of risk, diversification, or how compounding interest works.
Yeah.
He can show Carl a historical chart of how equities have performed against bonds over the last 50 years.
He could even take Carl's age and say, generally speaking, academic models suggest someone with your timeline should look at a 60-40 stock-to-bond mix. That is all safe harbored as education.
But where is the line? When does it stop being an academic discussion and start being a regulatory liability?
The line is specificity and a call to action. The absolute second frantic Frank bridges the gap between theory and execution.
Give me an example.
If Frank says, you need a 60-40 mix, so I want you to put that 60% into our firm's XYZ growth fund.
Up, boom.
Boom. The safe harbor vanishes in a puff of smoke. Education just ended. A recommendation just began.
So as long as Frank is speaking like a college professor, he's safe. The minute he speaks like a salesman, the rules attach.
Precisely. It's a very clear line if you look for the product name.
Okay, so we've established when the suitability rule is triggered. Now we need to understand how it actually works mechanically.
Let's do it.
Because it's not just a gut feeling of, yeah, this seems fine for Carl. FineNR has a highly structured evaluation process. I've heard this described as a three-layer cake, but that doesn't really explain how it filters out bad advice.
A cake implies you just stack things on top of each other.
Oh.
A better analogy is a heavy-duty three-stage water filtration system.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. A recommendation has to pass through filter one, 8ND filter two, AND filter three. If it gets blocked by even one of those filters, the recommendation is unsuitable and you cannot make it.
Okay, let's run a recommendation through the system. Filter number one is reasonable basis suitability.
So this first filter has absolutely nothing to do with Cautious Carl. It's entirely about the product itself.
Yep.
The firm and the rep have to understand the underlying mechanics of what they're selling. What are the risks? What are the rewards? What are the fees?
Because it's the poison filter. Does this product just inherently kill people?
Essentially, yes.
Ah.
Think back to the 2008 financial crisis.
Oh, man, what a mess.
Right. You had broker-dealers selling massively complex, collateralized debt obligations. CDOs that were so mathematically convoluted that the brokers themselves didn't understand what triggered a default.
Wow.
FineNR looked at that and said, never again. Reasonable basis suitability means that before a customer even exists, the firm must do its due diligence.
So they have to know how it works.
Exactly. If the broker-dealer doesn't understand how a leveraged mutual fund behaves in a down market, they can't sell it to anyone, period. Doesn't matter if the customer is a billionaire genius. If the firm didn't do its homework, the rule is violated.
Okay, so filter one ensures the water isn't toxic. Assuming the product is fundamentally sound for someone, we move to filter number two, customer-specific suitability.
This is the filter most people think of when they hear the word suitability. We know the product is okay for someone, but is it okay for the specific plant we are trying to water?
Right.
Is it okay for Cautious Carl? This is where Frank takes the product's risk profile and overlays it onto those nine factors we gathered in Carl's customer investment profile.
Okay, so if Carl is risk averse in a low tax bracket and needs his money liquid in 6 months for a down payment on a house.
Yeah.
And Frank recommends a highly volatile 20-year maturity corporate bond fund.
Yeah.
It gets caught in filter two. The match is terrible. The plant drowns.
Exactly. Filter two requires a direct logical connection between the customer's profile and the recommended security.
Makes sense.
But here is where it gets insidious. Let's say Frank recommends a high-quality short-term bond fund. It passes filter one because it's a real understood product. And it passes filter two because it perfectly matches Carl's need for safety and liquidity.
So Frank thinks he's in the clear.
He thinks he is.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a third filter, quantitative suitability.
Quantitative suitability. Okay, what is that?
Quantitative suitability zooms out. Instead of looking at a single isolated trade, it looks at the pattern or the flow rate of a series of recommended trades.
A pattern.
Right. Even if every single trade is perfectly suitable on its own under filter two, a rep can still violate filter three if they are recommending trades too frequently.
But wait, why would doing a bunch of good trades be a bad thing?
Because every trade usually comes with a cost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, commissions, spreads, or tax consequences.
Ah, the fees.
Yep. If Frank is calling Carl every week to switch from one perfectly suitable bond fund to another perfectly suitable bond fund, the constant friction of those transaction costs will eventually eat up Carl's principal. It's designed to prevent excessive trading.
Okay, listener, active recall time. This is a massive point of confusion on the exam, so listen closely.
This one trips everybody up.
What if Cautious Carl is the one technically directing his own account? Frank doesn't have formal legal discretionary control. Frank isn't pushing a button on his own. Frank just calls Carl with an idea, and Carl makes the final call to authorize the switch. Does Frank still get in trouble for excessive trades if he doesn't have formal control over the account? Take a beat.
Got your answer. The answer is absolutely yes. Frank is still on the hook.
Wait, really? Even if Carl is saying yes every single time?
Yes. Finn explicitly updated the rule to remove the requirement for the rep to have control over the account to be hit with a quantitative suitability violation.
Wow.
If Frank keeps pitching and Carl keeps swinging, Frank is legally responsible for the sheer volume of pitches.
But isn't that just churning? I thought churning was a huge fraud charge.
This is where we have to separate the regulatory mechanisms.
Mm.
Churning is indeed a severe fraud charge under SEC rules.
Right.
But to prove churning, regulators have to prove intent, what lawyers call scienter. They have to prove Frank intentionally meant to defraud Carl to line his own pockets. And they usually need to show Frank had control of the account.
That sounds like a very high legal bar to clear.
It's incredibly high. So quantitative suitability is the regulator's workaround.
Ah, so it's easier to prove.
Exactly. A quantitative suitability violation is just a regulatory failure. It does not require the regulators to prove Frank intended to defraud anyone, and it does not require him to have control.
It just requires the math.
Yes, just mathematical proof that the pattern of recommendations was excessive and inconsistent with the customer's profile. It's a much easier charge for FINRA to make stick.
Man, Frank cannot catch a break.
So, filter one, the product. Filter two, the match. Filter three, the series of trades. Now, I know there's one other little side rule attached to this whole process. Capacity to pay.
Yeah, it's an important nuance, especially when dealing with insurance-based products or margin.
Give me an example.
Let's say Frank recommends a variable annuity to Carl. It perfectly matches Carl's objective of lifetime income and his moderate risk tolerance. It passes all three filters.
Okay.
But the systematic premium payments are $2,000 a month, and Carl's profile shows he only has $500 a month of disposable income.
So Carl literally just cannot afford the thing Frank is pitching. Right. The rule explicitly prohibits recommending a transaction or a continuing purchase strategy unless the firm has a reasonable basis to believe the customer has the financial ability to meet that commitment.
So it doesn't matter how flawless the investment is for his long-term goals.
Exactly. If it bankrupts his monthly cash flow, it is fundamentally unsuitable.
Okay, so that is the rigorous three-stage gauntlet we put cautious Carl through. The regulators are treating him like a fragile ecosystem that needs intense protection.
Very fragile.
But what if our customer isn't Carl? What if frantic Frank lands the whale? What if his customer is 50 million Fiona?
Here we go.
She didn't make $50 million by letting people hold her hand. She runs a tech empire, she moves fast, and she thinks standard suitability questionnaires are a total waste of her time.
She's got places to be.
Right. Do regulators force Frank to put Fiona through the exact same three-stage filtration system?
They don't. The regulators recognize a concept called the institutional customer exemption. The philosophy here is that not all customers are vulnerable retail investors. If a customer qualifies for this VIP pass, they are presumed to have the resources and sophistication to fend for themselves to a certain degree.
Whoa. Okay, but who actually gets the VIP pass? I know obvious entities count banks, insurance companies, registered investment companies, savings and loans. They are massive institutions. But Fiona is just a person, a very rich person, but legally just a natural human being.
And this is a highly testable distinction on the exam.
Oh, really?
Yes. The definition of an institutional account includes a wildcard provision, any other person, including a natural person, with at least $50 million in total assets.
Wow.
Because Fiona has $50 million, she meets the legal baseline to be treated like a bank.
Okay, but Frank can't just look at her massive yacht, check her bank balance, and say, sweet, rules don't apply, let's sell her the craziest derivatives we have. Having money doesn't automatically make you a financial genius.
You're exactly right, and FINRA agrees with you. Clearing the $50 million asset hurdle is only step one.
There are more steps.
Oh, yeah. For the exemption to actually apply to a recommendation, there are three distinct hurdles, and all three must be cleared.
Let's hear them.
Hurdle one is institutional account status. Fiona clears this with her $50
million. Okay. Triple.
Hurdle two, the first ad, the firm must have a reasonable basis to believe that Fiona is actually capable of evaluating investment risks independently.
So Frank can't just assume it.
No, he had to assess her sophistication, her use of outside consultants, and her experience with the specific type of asset he's pitching.
So if she made $50 million inventing a new type of shoelace, but knows nothing about collateralized debt, she might fail hurdle two.
Precisely. And hurdle three is the most mechanical this for. Fiona must affirmatively indicate that she is exercising independent judgment in evaluating the recommendations.
Okay, listener, active recall time. Pay very close attention to the wording here.
This is a classic trap.
Let's say Frantic Frank wants to save time and streamline his paperwork. He sends Fiona a certified letter that says, "Dear Fiona, because you have over $50 million, we are going to assume you evaluate your own risk and we will no longer be performing customer-specific suitability checks for you. If you disagree with this, please call our office."
Uh-huh.
Fiona is busy on her yacht. She glances at the letter, throws it away, and stays completely silent. Does the institutional exemption apply? Take a beat.
Got it. The answer is a hard no.
A hard no.
Negative consent, which means silence or a failure to object, is never, ever enough to trigger this exemption.
Oh, wow.
Fiona has to actively, affirmatively state, either verbally or in writing, "Yes, Frank, I am evaluating my own risk."
FINRA essentially requires her to actively opt in to the danger zone. They won't let Frank sneak her in through the back door.
Exactly.
Okay, let's say she does opt in. She signs a paper saying, "I, 50 million Fiona, exercise independent judgment." Frank clears all three hurdles. So what exactly gets waived? Do we toss all three of our water filters out the window?
This is where candidates stumble on the exam, because they assume the exemption is total.
It's not.
It is not. If we connect this back to our three filters, only filter two is waived. The customer-specific obligation is gone. The exemption says Fiona is smart enough to look at a product and figure out if it is a good match for her specific situation, so Frank doesn't have to do that matchmaking work.
But filter one and filter three still apply.
Absolutely. Filter one, reasonable basis suitability, always applies. Frank still has to understand the product he is selling her. He cannot sell her a totally fraudulent, undiligent security just because she's rich.
You still can't sell poison.
Exactly. And filter three, quantitative suitability, still applies to prevent excessive trading. You still can't drown in transaction costs. The exemption is very narrowly focused just on the matchmaking aspect.
Okay, that makes total sense. We protect retail investors like Carl with the full three-layer system, and we let institutional giants like Fiona skip the middle layer if they promise they know what they are doing.
That's a great summary.
But here is where the plot twists massively. For decades, the FINRA suitability standard was the law of the land. But then, after years of intense debate, lobbying, and the spectacular failure of a similar Department of Labor rule, the SEC looked at the FINRA suitability rule for retail customers and decided, you know what? Merely suitable just isn't good enough anymore.
This was a seismic shift in the regulatory landscape,
mm-hmm.
arguably the biggest in a generation. It birthed Regulation Best Interest, or REGBI.
Or REGBI.
Right. To understand why it happened, you have to look at the flaw in the word suitable. Suitable just means not wrong.
Not wrong.
Yeah. If Frank had two mutual funds that both fit cautious Carl's profile perfectly, but one paid Frank a much higher commission, the old suitability rule allowed Frank to sell the more expensive one. It was suitable.
But it obviously wasn't the best thing for Carl.
Exactly. So REGBI stepped in and required broker-dealers to act in a retail customer's best interest at the time a recommendation is made, explicitly forbidding the firm from placing their financial interest ahead of the customer's.
It absorbed the FINRA suitability rule for retail customers and upgraded the entire operating system.
It really did.
But let's clarify a crucial limitation on that operating system. REGBI applies at the time of the recommendation. Let's say Frank recommends a stellar mutual fund to Carl on Tuesday. On Wednesday, a global pandemic hits and the market tanks. Did Frank violate REGBI by not calling Carl on Wednesday morning to sell? Is Frank under a continuous duty to manage Carl's money?
No, and that is a critical distinction that the exam will definitely test.
Yeah.
REGBI is not a continuous fiduciary duty.
Okay, explain that.
Well, investment advisors, people who charge ongoing fees for management under the Advisors Act, they have a continuous fiduciary duty.
Yeah.
But broker-dealers under REGBI only owe this elevated standard at the exact moment the recommendation is executed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Once the trade is done, the duty goes dormant. There is no ongoing monitoring duty unless the firm specifically contracted to provide one.
Okay, so REGBI only flashes on when a recommendation happens. But how does a firm actually prove they acted in the best interest during that flash? It's not just a pledge, it's a structural requirement.
It is very structured.
REGBI breaks down into four component obligations. I call them the four C's to keep them straight in my head. Disclosure, care, conflict of interest, and compliance. Walk me through how these actually function in the real world.
Let's start with the disclosure obligation. Before or at the time of the recommendation, the firm must provide full and fair written disclosure of all material facts about the relationship.
Okay.
They have to tell Carl exactly what the fees are, the scope of services, and they must explicitly state that they are acting in a broker-dealer capacity, not an advisory capacity.
They have to hand over the blueprint of the relationship. Then comes the care obligation.
The care obligation is essentially the old three-stage FINRA suitability filter we just talked about. Reasonable basis, customer-specific, and quantitative, but fundamentally upgraded.
Upgraded how?
Instead of running a recommendation through the filters and asking, is this suitable? Frank has to run it through and ask, is this in Carl's best interest, regardless of how much I get paid?
Which brings us to the most aggressive part of the rule, the conflict of interest obligation.
This one is highly testable because it forces broker dealers to re-engineer how they pay their reps. Firms must have written policies to identify conflicts. If it's a standard material conflict, they must at least disclose it in writing.
Right.
But if it's a conflict that creates a structural incentive for the rep to place their own interest ahead of the customer's, the firm must actively mitigate that incentive.
So tell the client about the temptation or systematically dial back the temptation.
Exactly.
But there is one specific type of conflict that has a zero tolerance policy. Let's go back to our cold open at the start of the show.
The toaster.
Frantic Frank's firm manager comes to him and says, "Hey, Frank, we are running a promo. If you sell $100,000 of the XYZ mutual fund by the end of this month, we will give you a free toaster and a $5,000 cash bonus."
The classic sales contest.
Yeah. It is a sales contest tied to a specific security within a limited time period. Now, Frank is an honest guy. He wants the toaster. Can he just disclose this to Carl? Can he write on a piece of paper, "Hey, Carl, buying this fund is good for you, but you should know it also helps me win a toaster," and have Carl sign it?
Absolutely not. Under Reg BI, sales contests, quotas, bonuses, or non-cash compensation tied to specific securities within a limited period of time must be eliminated entirely.
Eliminate.
Disclosure is not a cure. Mitigation is not a cure.
Why? Why can't a fully informed adult customer just agree to help Frank get a toaster?
Because the SEC determined that this specific incentive structure is fundamentally, mathematically incompatible with acting in a customer's best interest.
The temptation is just too high.
Exactly. The pressure of a ticking clock, combined with a specific product target, will inevitably warp a broker's judgment. The temptation is too great. The regulators simply ban the practice.
Straight to regulatory jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect your toaster. You cannot run a limited time contest on a specific stock or fund.
That's right.
Okay. And the fourth C is the compliance obligation, which basically just mandates that the firm has to write all these policies down in a manual and actively enforce them.
Right. Now, you might be wondering, how does cautious Carl actually get that initial disclosure we mentioned in the first obligation? How does he get the blueprint of the relationship?
I'm wondering that.
The SEC created a specific physical document to accomplish this, Form CRS, which stands for Customer Relationship Summary.
Form CRS is the physical manifestation of the SEC wanting retail investors to actually understand who they're dealing with in plain English. And the exam loves testing the physical rules of this form.
They love it.
If you are a standalone broker-dealer or a standalone investment advisor, your Form CRS can be a maximum of 2 pages.
Right. If you are a dual registrant offering both services, you get a maximum of 4 pages. And the formatting is incredibly strict. It must have 5 specific sections in a specific order. Do we need to know the order?
Yes.
Introduction, relationships and services, fees and conflicts, disciplinary history, and additional information. It even includes bolded conversation starters, literally pre-written questions that the form begs the customer to ask the rep, like, "How might your conflicts of interest affect me?"
It's basically the SEC giving the customer a script to interrogate their broker. So when does cautious Carl actually get this form handed to him?
For a new retail investor, it must be delivered before or at the earliest of 3 triggers: recommending an account type or transaction, placing an order, or opening a brokerage account. Whichever of those happens first, the form has to be in their hands.
Okay, active recall time, listener. Think about this scenario.
Here we go.
Let's say cautious Carl already has an account with Frank. They went through the Form CRS process 3 years ago. No new account is being opened today. But Carl mentions he just retired, and Frank recommends that Carl take his old 401k from his previous employer and roll it over into his existing brokerage account. Does Carl get a new Form CRS? Take a beat.
Think you know it. The answer is yes. A recommendation to roll over retirement assets is a standalone trigger for Form CRS delivery.
Even though he already has an account and already got the form 3 years ago.
Yes. A rollover is considered such a massive consequential financial decision that the SEC requires a fresh delivery of the relationship summary to ensure the customer understands exactly how the broker is getting paid on that specific massive chunk of money.
That is a huge exam point. Also, remember the countdown clocks on Form CRS? If the firm changes something material on the form, like they change their fee structure, they have 30 days to file the updated version with the SEC and post it on our website.
Right, 30 days.
But they have 60 days to communicate that amendment to their existing retail customers, and they have to do it for free.
30 days to fix it in public, 60 days to tell your current clients. And it's important to remember that Form CRS is a summary, not a contract.
That's a good point.
Yeah, handing it to a customer doesn't create a new legal agreement. It just describes the nature of the relationship they're entering.
Okay, we have covered massive ground. We've gone from the KYC baseline to the triggers of a recommendation, through the three water filters of Funeral suitability, given Fiona her VIP exemption, and upgraded Carl with Reg BI.
We've been busy.
Let's move into our final section, specialized scenarios. Because the rules are rigid, but they adapt when you start introducing fancy algorithms or stepping into different regulatory jurisdictions.
A prime example of this is the investment analysis tool rule.
Right. Let's say Frantic Frank wants to sound incredibly sophisticated to Carl. He boots up a complex Monte Carlo simulator on his computer. He inputs Carl's age, income, tax bracket, and risk tolerance. And the software runs 10,000 randomized simulations to project the statistical likelihood of Carl running out of money in retirement. It spits out a beautiful graph.
Which is incredibly helpful for a visual learner like Carl. But regulators inherently distrust black boxes.
Oh, for sure.
If a machine is spitting out a projection of the future, regulators want to know exactly what math the machine is using.
Because you could easily program the machine to just tell the client to buy whatever makes the broker the most money, right?
Exactly. Because a tool like that produces statistical probabilities of future outcomes, it falls under the investment analysis tool rule. And this rule demands very specific written narrative disclosures.
Like what?
Frank cannot just hand Carl the output graph. He must provide a clear written explanation of the tool's methodology, its limitations, and the key assumptions it makes about market returns.
Frank also has to disclose the universe of investments the tool considered. If the tool is secretly programmed to only search for mutual funds that Frank's specific firm happens to sell, Carl needs to know he's looking at a rigged game.
And this raises a critical point about financial bias. The rule explicitly states that if the tool favors certain securities because the firm receives revenue from them, like higher 12b1 fees or back-end revenue sharing, that revenue bias must be prominently disclosed.
So Frank essentially has to say, hey, Carl, this super smart robot says you should buy this fund, but you should know my firm gets paid extra cash when you buy this specific fund. You have to show your mathematical work and your wallet.
Exactly.
Now, the rule requires most of these disclosures to be written clearly, but you can paraphrase them in plain English, okay. Except for one. There is one disclosure that has to be in exact fixed wording.
Yes. The regulators demand that the firm print this exactly. Important. The projections or other information generated by, and then you insert the tool name regarding the likelihood of various investment outcomes, are hypothetical in nature, do not reflect actual investment results, and are not guarantees of future results. You drop the tool's name in the bracket and you change absolutely nothing else.
Okay, listener, another active recall scenario. Everyone listen closely because this is a classic trap.
Oh yeah, they love this one.
FINRA obviously wants to keep an eye on these predictive tools to make sure they aren't misleading. So, how many days does Frantic Frank's firm have to file this new Monte Carlo simulator with FINRA before they let Frank use it with clients? Is it a 10-day pre-filing rule? A 30-day post-use rule? Think about it.
You ready? It's a trick question.
A trick question.
There is no 10-day or 30-day filing deadline for investment analysis tools. FINRA does not have the manpower to check the coding of every single algorithm before it launches. So the rule states the firm must provide FINRA's advertising regulation department access to the tool upon request.
Upon request. Treat any number of days on the exam regarding FINRA access to these tools as a giant glowing red decoy. It is upon request, period.
Now let's pivot to our last specialized scenario, municipal securities. When we talk about municipals, we are bringing in an entirely different rule book written by a different regulator, the MSRB, or Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board.
But wait, why do Series 6 candidates care about municipal securities? A Series 6 rep can't sell a general obligation water bond for the city of Chicago. You need a Series 7 or a Series 52 for that.
You're right. They can't sell municipal bonds. But the Series 6 license covers municipal fund securities. Specifically, 529 college savings plans, local government investment pools, LGIPs, and ABLE accounts for individuals with disabilities.
Ah, okay.
These are structured like mutual funds, but they're created by state and local governments. So when Frank recommends a 529 plan to Carl, he crosses jurisdictions into MSRB territory.
Okay, so the MSRB has its own suitability rule. And unsurprisingly, it looks almost exactly like the FINRA three-stage filter. reasonable basis, customer-specific, and quantitative. But wait, we just spent 20 minutes talking about how RegBI upgraded suitability for retail customers, so we have a massive jurisdiction battle here.
We do.
If Cautious Carl, a retail customer, walks in to buy a 529 plan for his grandson, does the SEC's RegBI apply, or does this MSRB suitability rule apply?
RegBI wins.
Oh, really?
Yes. The MSRB explicitly amended their own rule to state that if a recommendation is subject to RegBI, the MSRB municipal suitability rule steps aside. They did this to prevent regulatory overlap. They didn't want reps doing double the paperwork for the exact same retail customer.
So RegBI protects Carl when he buys a 529. When does the MSRB suitability rule actually apply on its own?
It applies when the municipal recommendation is made to a non-retail customer, like an institutional account that doesn't trigger RegBI.
Got it. But regardless of which exact rule applies RegBI or MSRB when you are recommending municipal products, there is one factor in the customer profile that becomes incredibly radioactive if you ignore it.
We touched on this earlier, tax status. The primary benefit of almost all municipal securities is that the interest or the growth is tax exempt at the federal level.
Right.
Because the government is offering you that massive tax benefit, these products typically pay a lower yield than a comparable corporate product.
Which brings us back to the tax trap. Let's look at Cautious Carl again. He is retired, living on a modest fixed income. He is in the lowest possible tax bracket. He barely pays federal income tax. If Frantic Frank recommends a tax-exempt municipal product to Carl, Frank is waving a massive red flag in front of a regulatory bull.
Exactly. Carl does not need the tax exemption because he's barely paying taxes anyway. But if he buys the muni product, he is forced to accept the lower yield that comes with it.
Oh.
He eats the cost of the tax shield without getting any of the benefit.
That's terrible for Carl.
It is. Recommending tax-exempt munis to a low tax bracket customer is a classic, highly testable violation.
It's the umbrella in the desert. And when it comes to 529 college savings plans specifically, there's another major profile factor that dictates the recommendation: investment time horizon.
529 plans operate like mutual funds. They have different share classes like Class A, Class C, and the choice of share class hinges almost entirely on how long the money will stay invested before the kid goes to college.
Let's play this out. Carl is opening a 529 for his grandson, who is a high school sophomore. The kid is going to college in 2 years. The time horizon is incredibly short.
In that scenario, Frank should avoid recommending share classes with high upfront sales charges, like Class A shares. The math doesn't work. Carl doesn't have enough years in the market to amortize or spread out that heavy front-end cost before he needs to withdraw the money.
But if Carl is opening a 529 for his newborn granddaughter, he has 18 years.
Then the math flips. Over an 18-year horizon, he can take the hit on the front-end load of a Class A share. Because over two decades, the lower ongoing annual expenses of that specific share class will save him a ton of money compared to a Class C share that charges higher fees every single year.
Right.
The product mechanics absolutely have to match the timeline.
All right, listener, you've survived the deep dive. Shake off the heavy details. We are going to do a rapid fire exam recap. I am going to fire off scenarios based on what we just covered. I want you to shout the answer in your head before my expert here gives the one sentence rule. This is how you lock it in. Ready?
I'm ready. Let's run it.
Number one, if Cautious Carl refuses to give his tax status or net worth, can Frantic Frank still open his account?
Yes, the account can open under the basic KYC rules, but Frank cannot make any recommendations that require that missing information.
Number two, Cautious Carl bought a fund on a whim 2 years ago online. Today he asks Frank if he should stay in it, and Frank says keep holding. Is this a recommendation?
Yes. A recommendation to hold is a call to action, and it resets the clock requiring a fresh suitability analysis against Carl's current profile.
Number three, 50 million Fiona has enough money to qualify as an institutional account, but she ignores Frank's letter asking for her affirmative consent to evaluate her own risk. Is she exempt from customer-specific suitability?
No, silence is not consent.
Yeah.
She must actively and affirmatively say yes to waive the customer-specific protection.
Number four, Frantic Frank's firm wants to run a 30-day sales contest offering a bonus for selling the XYZ mutual fund. Can the firm just clearly put this conflict of interest in the form CRS disclosure?
No. Under RegBI, sales contests tied to specific securities in a limited period of time must be strictly eliminated, not just disclosed.
Number five, last one. How many days does Frank have to give FINRA access to his new Monte Carlo retirement simulator before he uses it?
It's a trick question. There is no set number of days. FINRA must be provided access strictly upon request.
Nailed it. Listener, if you got those, you're in incredible shape.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over as you study. If you look at the broad sweep of regulatory history we covered today, moving from KYC to the three-stage suitability filter, all the way to the strict conflict-eliminating standards of regulation best interest, you are watching a massive philosophical shift in American finance.
How so?
The entire regulatory framework shifted from asking a negative question, is this merely suitable, meaning is it not wrong, to demanding an affirmative standard, is this in your absolute best interest?
Wow.
That single change in language completely shifted the burden of proof. It used to be on the customer to prove they were wronged by a broker. Now, under RegBI, the burden is on the firm to proactively prove they put the customer first. Every disclosure, every rule, every elimination of a sales contest we covered today is just a mechanism to enforce that exact philosophy.
So the next time you see a jagged, confusing rule on the exam or a murky scenario where Frank is trying to figure out what to do, just remember the philosophy. Ask yourself, which answer proves the firm put the customer first? That is the ultimate cheat code for the Series 6. Thank you for joining us on this journey. Keep drilling, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.